Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, the podcast channel here in the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the double delight, the pleasure of welcoming two guests to the podcast today. Dr. Kojan Bohanic, who is assistant professor in Sanskrit and Jain Studies at Arihant Institute for Jain Studies. He's also a visiting assistant professor at Claremont School of Theology. And also, I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the podcast Dr. Rita Sharma, who is a center director and associate professor and core doctoral faculty at the Graduate Theological Union Center. Welcome both to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course, we are speaking on a work that both of them have co-edited, along with Dr. Purushottama Bilimoria, who is unable to join us today. Work, of course, called Contemplative Studies in Jainism, Meditation, Prayer, and Veneration. Now, in the first line of inquiry we usually engage is, the backstory. What the genesis? How did this come into being? Where did this idea come from?
So maybe I'll start off with that. So years ago, many years ago, I think maybe 2015, maybe even earlier, we started doing a series of conferences at the American Academy of Religion through the auspices of the Dharma Academy of North America, which is a scholarly organization for the study of Jainism, Hinduism, and Buddhism in particular, and yoga traditions, etc. And we decided that we wanted to look at contemplative studies in these traditions, prayer, worship, meditation, but much more than that. And in the process of doing multiple such conferences, we had material for a volume, an edited volume, which was called Contemplative Studies in Hinduism, and enough material for an edited volume on Contemplative Studies in Jainism. And we also had so much interest from this that more books are on their way. A third volume has started already, the Contemplative Studies and the Arts and Aesthetics of Yoga, which is forthcoming. Devashish Banerjee, professor at California Institute of Integral Studies, and myself. So this is how it started. And our premise at the very beginning was that when we think of contemplative studies, we often think of mindfulness, vipassana, or just pure meditation focused on breath, or what we call dhyana in Sanskrit. But that is just the tip of the iceberg, because if you think about it phenomenologically, a lot of embodied practices in Jain, Hindu, and Buddhist traditions are essentially contemplative practices, including all private personal pujas and a lot of bhakti practices and so much else.
I could add to that too. So I got my master's degree at the Institute for Buddhist Studies at the Graduate Theological Union, which is run by a Jodo Shinshu Buddhist organization, whose main contemplative practice is mantra meditation. Actually, they don't call it mantra, but reciting the holy name of Amitabha Buddha, or Amida Buddha in Japanese. And there's a lot of sort of friction there between Shin Buddhist scholars and mainstream Buddhist studies, where they tend to feel as though they've been disenfranchised from conversations around contemplative studies, because often the assumptions around contemplative studies are Protestantism. The history of Protestantism in the West, we see with like the Quakers listening to the inner light and this idea of quietude, meditation and silence and quietude. We have something similar in Ignatian meditation, for example. But the Shin Buddhists, very much want a place at the table when it comes to speaking about meditative practice and contemplative practice. So they assert that, their practices also are contemplative practices. And I see that sort of there being a real kinship between this project with the Jain community and Jain traditions, and that a lot of times in the conversations, as Dr. Sharma's indicating, around contemplative practices and meditation, it's assumed that there's only one legitimate form of meditation, something that looks very much like Vipassana, or even something that looks very much like Soto Zen. But the Dharma world is very broad. And, we're trying to sort of broaden the rubric of what we can consider contemplative practices that's more inclusive of a variety of traditions, and in this case, the Jain tradition, that includes the embodied practices that Dr. Sharma mentioned, but also puja, singing, chanting, and a variety of these other practices where the practitioner really experiences what we might call an elevated state of consciousness in the practice, something that's contemplative, something that sort of makes one more acutely aware of one's position in the sort of grand narrative of the cosmos, which is, you know, a lot of what religious practice seeks to do. So there's really a sort of broadening of the franchise here and a more inclusive approach to defining contemplative practices that's really at the core of this project, sort of invite traditions like the Jain tradition to the table so that they have something to say about how to define and how to understand contemplative practices.
Perhaps say a word contextualizing, you know, why this is important in terms of the umbrella of contemplative practices. Is there a particular significance or value or nuance, or, you know, in terms of that field of study or that umbrella in the imaginary? And then, you know, why is it significant that we broaden that and include Jainism therein?
Well, I mean, I think like any other tradition, the Jain tradition wants to have a voice in sort of directing culture and being relevant, socially relevant. I mean, there's some survival mechanism at work there. You know, like many Dharma traditions or South Asian traditions, particularly in the diaspora, there's a reluctance amongst first, second generation and third generation people from Dharma traditions of South Asia to take up the practices of their ancestors. So being included in these sort of places where religious discussions are socially relevant and influence our culture in general, I think is the interest of any tradition. And so conversely, when we define certain fields of religion in a way that's exclusive of these traditions, there's almost a colonial effect of disempowering these traditions and not giving them a seat at the table in defining these rubrics.
Fascinating. Kojin, while you have the floor, do you want to say a little bit about your contribution to the volume?
Sure. So I was the editor, and I edited, obviously, all of this, co-editor with Dr. Rita Sharma and Dr. Bill Moria. They're mentors of mine at the Graduate Theological Union, where I received my PhD under Dr. Sharma as my advisor. And so it was really a lot of, you know, what I'm saying has been directly taught to me by Dr. Sharma. So she really, you know, sort of uplifted me into this role and connected me with the broader field of Jain studies in other ways as well. My contribution was as an editor, editing it, dealing with the emails between publishers and authors, you know, the usual things that an editor for a volume would do. But I also composed one of the chapters. And the chapter that I did is sort of an ongoing project of mine. I'm working on a book right now on Jain yoga and its relationship to what we might call philosophical pragmatism, you know, something in the image of William James as a dialogue, you know, not trying to speak over the tradition, but to, you know, sort of look at how pragmatic understandings can help us understand. There's a sort of pragmatism in the approach of Jain yoga, whereby there's a shared heuristic structure amongst yoga traditions. So we see like the yamas of the Yoga Sutra, Ahimsa, Satya, Sthaya, Brahmacharya, Parigraha, this being also part of the Anuvratas and the Mahavratas of the Jain tradition. They're also used within the Buddhist tradition. We see contemplative structures of, what I spoke a lot in that chapter was the interiority of concentrating and withdrawing one's attention, concentrating and withdrawing one's attention. So there's all these shared sort of structures across yoga traditions. So for example, the Hemachandra Yoga Shastra very much employs a lot of the same heuristic structures of the Hindu Yoga Sutra. And you could do something similar by looking at like the Buddhist Visuddhimagga, for example, where we have elements of Bhavana or the Brahmavihara that are also shared. So that sort of interfaith dialogue where the Jain tradition validates other yoga traditions is a viable means for spiritual progression by using the shared heuristic structures to value other traditions leads to a certain interfaith goodwill and peace building that's in line with the spirit of nonviolence of the chains. And so that's kind of the broader project that I've been working on for several years and that I'm writing the book on. And this chapter here really kind of instantiates one particular point of dialogue there between the Hemachandra Yoga Shastra and the Hindu Yoga Sutra.
Fascinating. Do you think you want to comment maybe for our more general audience, you know, in terms of Jain studies, is this a dwindling field? Is it a burgeoning field? You know, what's happening in terms of the overlap between academia and Jainism?
Dr. Sharma, do you want to take that one?
I think that it's important to recognize that Jain studies is indeed burgeoning and sort of exploding on the scene. Coming back to, again, the American Academy of Religion and the 20 years of conferences that we have run through the Dharma Academy of North America, that was the first sort of forum where Jain studies could be presented at the AAR. Jainism didn't even have its own program unit until much later. We started in 2002 or three. And now Jainism has its own program unit at the AAR. That is sort of a coming of age, but much more importantly, the Jain community in the United States has funded chairs, professorships, lectureships, postdoctoral positions, funding for conferences, all manner of development work and advancement work that the Jain community has done, the Jain heritage community has done for Jain studies. This is absolutely revolutionary in that it is changing the way religious studies and cultural studies are going to be addressed in the academy, because humanities programs and departments are shutting down everywhere. And Jain studies is growing. So the input from communities is extremely important. And to keep these studies, these fields, these disciplines alive. And I think that what the Jain communities understood is that you can make sure that there's plenty of academic freedom, that scholars have the freedom and liberty to write intellectually rigorous critical work, but at the same time that they take the community self-understanding serious. And while this has been going on, this new methodology known as autoethnography has become increasingly prevalent. And autoethnography, of course, is understanding one's role inside the field being studied, inside the tradition or culture being studied. Even if one is an insider, one is still an outsider, because you are critically reviewing not just the tradition or culture, but your own situatedness and your own experience. But at the same time, a practitioner's viewpoint becomes more important than it used to be if we're going to use methods like autoethnography. Over to you, Kojin.
Yeah, thanks. There's almost a refrain, there's almost a refrain in the field of Jain studies, and it's an observation that Jains have historically been disproportionately influential on South Asian culture. You know, they've always been a very minority religion. Yet arguably, we see a lot of, for example, the Shramana movement, which affects Buddhist, Hindu, and Jain traditions, is being driven a lot by Jains. The centrality of ahimsa, nonviolence, is a central ethos, a central virtue. That also is very much perhaps attributed in part to the disproportionate influence of the Jain community. And I don't know if there's a scholar who's working on this, but I would be curious to see if the current sort of funding on the part of the Jain community of the academy is sort of continuation of that pattern where there's a certain, it really is a way of understanding the importance of representation in culture and representation in the academy, and the sort of, I don't like using a Reagan term, but the sort of trickle-down effect that has in the academy. If those in the academy are influenced by Jane's studies, then our culture will be influenced by Jane's studies. And, currently in the diaspora, there's really the problem of second generation people of all South Asian traditions not really sticking to the tradition or adhering to it with the same piety of the previous generations who are from South Asia. And so I think in part that this is a sort of like an optimistic appraisal of the ability of the academy, if supported, to help in the broader project of allowing culture and tradition to be understood. And this isn't like proselytizing, it's very interesting. The Jain history, of the religion, spread of the religion is, barely, proselytizing isn't really a thing, like, for example, Srimad Rajchandra told Mahatma Gandhi to stay Hindu. When Gandhi asked him if he should be Jain, he said, no, stay Hindu. In the history of missionary efforts, that's terrible advice, but it's not a missionary tradition. So this is really the idea that Jain values, such as nonviolence and non-possession, non-consumerism, intellectual nonviolence and goodwill to people with different belief systems, what's called the three A's of Jainism, ahimsa, parigraha, anicca-tapat, to have those types of values have sort of a broader sort of influence on the overall collective ethos of our culture, and perhaps in the process allow a degree of veneration and even pride maybe amongst the second and third generation in the diaspora, that their traditions are something to be proud of. They are venerable. They have a lot to contribute to the modern era. The value of knowledge in the modern era is not the mere instrumentality of knowledge given to us by STEM, but there's an intrinsic knowledge that can change who we are as people, which is the symptom of what we do. And that the Jain tradition has the potential to value the intrinsic value of knowledge, to change who we are as a people, which will thereby affect what we do as a culture. And I think that realization, that sort of optimism, is really strong in the Jain community. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Jain studies in the academy is so well supported.
Was there anything that surprised you about this process or this collection of studies or the resultant product? Anything that was literally remarkable to you about this journey?
Raj, I'm going to answer that from the point of view of the full series of contemplative studies and Asian traditions. And I think that, we started out in sort of arguing that prayer and worship are also contemplative, but it went way beyond that, because what we found, it's not that you don't know something; it's just that you haven't brought it into high relief yet, where no one else has. And so, what we found is that what had not been brought into high relief is this idea that meditations that elicit thought, imagination, emotion, and desire are not only mental or psychological avenues and praxis, that they are embodied practices involving remembrance of narratives of sacred literature, aided by vibrancy of imagination and remembrance, which evoke the power of emotion and will directed towards the goal of, liberation, freedom. And in the case of other Indic traditions, you could also add divine communion. So, there's these many different practices that are often looked at separately. The sound, culture of sound, visual and material culture, ritual studies, these are all looked at separately, aesthetics, but recitation, sacred art, poetry, sacred dance, drama, liturgical music, hymns, pilgrimage are all embraced under the rubric of embodied contemplative practices. And these comprise essentially, to use a cliche, meditation in motion, and are forms of praxis that are understood to lead to union, communion, or transcendence. And, you know, one of the catechisms of the Catholic Church in relation to contemplation was a question: what is meant by contemplation? And Pope Francis actually had explained this in terms of the way to enter into the mystery of redemption, which requires a contemplation that is, I'm quoting, mind, heart, knees, prayer. And I quote, can only be understood on bended knee in contemplation and not with the mind alone. So, you know, what does he mean by this? So a contemplation here is a prayerful state of interiority. It is experiential that includes the integration of reason, logic, feeling, but it's in an attitude of supplication, of what we call shraddha in Sanskrit, of a conviction, respect, faith. And such silent prayer acts in the Indic contemplative world of praxis are not uncommon. They integrate feeling with understanding / knowing and are considered to be a state of surrender, which opens the doorway to this mystery of liberation. And there are so many ways through which one can enter this mystery. And this is really the idea that contemplative life is not, as Khotin said earlier, so much only relegated to what we think of for Soto Zen meditation, but it's a shared category across so many traditions that can include prayer, worship, ritual, recitation, circumambulation, the reading of scripture, interpretation, even application of doctrine and application of principles. And of course, what is traditionally called meditation, which is much more kind of quiescence. And also, we want to go forward to include practices that transform awareness and that create a kind of a continuity between human life and the ultimate reality, however conceived.
I have a couple points too, if you don't mind. Thank you, Dr. Shermer, for setting the floor there. It sort of inspired some thoughts. I think there is a certain surprise that one might get in the process of reading this book. I think that I remember even studying religions as an undergraduate, and the way that the Jain tradition is described, it's very much an ascetic tradition. A lot of times it's reduced to salekhana, you know, the fasting to death, which almost no Jains ever practice. It's very, very rare. Very similar to how like Hinduism often gets reduced to like agora sadhus or something, you know. So there's sort of reductionism to the most sensational, you know, almost fetishizing aspects of the Jain tradition, this sort of like almost voyeuristic sort of entertainment kick that one gets off of looking at shocking elements of another tradition. And asceticism certainly provides that for those of us who are raised in a consumerist culture where the purpose of life is to acquire is the opposite of asceticism. So there's a sort of reduction to Jainism as the sort of bare asceticism that I think happens amongst scholars who are not necessarily Jain scholars, but maybe are broader religious studies practitioners. But I think in the course of reading our volume, we're going to find a lot more complexity there. So the things that I found kind of surprising, I think first and foremost, was the discourses on bhakti and the importance of bhakti in the Jain tradition, which is generally almost counterintuitive when you think of, you know, like the bhakti of the Nayanars or the Alwars, you know, the cripplation, the vast uncontrollable emotions, the,
you know, rolling on the ground and drooling that becomes very influential in the South, but then eventually influences the Northern traditions as well. So it is a more sparse bhakti, but a lot of the elements of ritual veneration that we do see in bhakti traditions are certainly there in the Jain tradition. And many of our chapters in this book, actually a lot of the chapters in the second half of this book, sort of deal with this sort of counterintuitive relationship between Jains and bhakti. You know, for example, samayik, right? The idea of having mental equanimity is very much valued, but there is also a place for veneration and puja and some of other practices, you know, that Dr. Sharma has spoken about. So, and then also, you know, like we see with the modern Jain Acharya, Srimad Rajchandra, you know, is considered very much a bhakti tradition. And when you read and translate Rajchandra's work, you'll see terms. For example, I recently translated the Siddhi Shastra, where we find terms like abhilasa, you know, very much sounds like a strong attachment to the object of one's ritual veneration, or even kama, desires having an important function in soteriological progression. Things that you wouldn't necessarily think of in the Jain tradition as an ascetic tradition, which largely seeks to eradicate the nokishais, right? These are like Bharat's traditional 8 or 9 by Abhinavagupta emotions. For the most part, Jains eradicate that. But then there is this sort of function, particularly in some of the discourses, which is another surprising thing about this work, in the discourses around the divine feminine in Jainism, which is something that I think that, you know, people don't really realize the importance. And several of the scholars in this work do really great job discussing the importance of the divine feminine, right? And there you start to see the importance of worldly achievement in the tradition, which is also another very surprising thing. You know, the roles of the divine feminine, the role of bhakti, even petitionary prayer, right? You don't really think of Jains as a non-theistic tradition. You don't think of them as having petitionary prayer. But there are beings at various different levels of the existence that you can petition. Maybe not the beings who are liberated from the material world, but that sort of petitionary prayer. Also, we see relationships with gurus, which have a petitionary sort of tone to them. We see a lot of texts and prayers that have that very strong petitionary element to it. And sometimes they get interpreted in a different way, you know, which one of our authors speaks about. So these are all things that I think challenge the sort of reductionist stereotype of Jainism as the sort of bare ascetic tradition. But it is a tradition that has a place for bhakti, for petitionary prayer, for veneration of the divine feminine, for the role of worldly aspirations assisting in one's spiritual progression. It does have a place for all of that within the contemplative structures of the Jain tradition. And I think a lot of people can really benefit from having that more nuanced understanding of the Jain tradition. I think that's a huge contribution of this work, is that it really challenges that reductionist stereotype.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It was fascinating looking through some of the papers because one absorbs a great deal by being in a particular context or culture. And I think it was, probably close to 20 years ago, I had the chance to go to attend the International Summer School for Jain Studies on one of their scholarships and was immersed. I mean, I was interested in ethics of violence as part of my MA work. I think it was from my MA at the time. It was just, you know, in many ways, there were various doctrinal and conceptual and philosophical demarcations and differences without question. There's a reason why Jainism is considered a very different school than the Gnostical schools, for example. And yet, on the ground, there was so much of praxis that was shared in terms of temple Jainism or, as you say, relationships with teachers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it really, really is fascinating. In terms of, you know, it would be great for people to know this, and certainly those listening to this podcast are clearly interested in Jainism or religion or culture, the humanities at large. But who do you think would most benefit from reading this book? What sort of subfields or interests or perspectives might this book most speak to?
Well, I think there's kind of a sort of, we can think of a hierarchical tree structure based on the sort of taxonomy of topics in the book. I think first and foremost, like Dr. Sharma has mentioned, is it really trying to give Jains a seat at the table in defining what contemplative studies is. So I think that sort of having a broader rubric, a more inclusive rubric of what exactly contemplative studies is, one that includes Dharma traditions, but even the Jain tradition, and things that are beyond, quietude, and silent, meditation. I think that contemplative studies really has a lot to learn there. I think comparative Dharma studies, it's very important to sort of understand the role of bhakti across Dharma traditions, for example. Or there's not a lot in Tantra in this book. It's allusions to it, things like mantra, which like Ellen Goh's work in her book really speaks about Jain Tantra. There's allusions to that. So, you can kind of see sort of these pan-Indic, pan-Dharmic sort of influences there, the contrast between contemplative studies. You know, as Dr. Sharma says, there's a certain mystery, I think, that most scholars of Dharma traditions have when we sort of look at very different philosophical systems doing very similar praxis, but really reflecting on the theology of those practices in totally different ways, and I think that's sort of answers how a lot of that nuance can be understood. Dharma traditions, shared Dharma traditions. I think this has a lot to bring to the field of Jain studies. I think that the field of Jain studies is a little bit more methodologically diverse than maybe some other fields. And I think that's because there's a little bit more of a charitable rendering towards the Jain tradition, I think, in the field of Jain studies, and there might be in some other fields where the scholars, even though they may take an edict or an objectivist sort of epistemology, they'll still have a sympathetic sort of approach and a charitable attempt to understand those traditions, even with very difficult subjects, like some of the scholarship that's been done on Jain mantra healing of cancer and things like that. I mean, I've been surprised at how charitable Jain scholars are in observing those things, because it'd be very easy to critique the claim that a mantra will cure cancer. But even around an issue like that, there's a certain charity amongst Jain scholars. So I think that this really contributes to Jain scholarship because it's methodologically diverse. I think the very nature of contemplative studies is one that values the first person subjective epistemic standpoint. And I think that, we can still study that standpoint objectively, but this sort of like balance between like, should we always be completely objective about how we understand religious studies? Is there a certain point where there's a sort of epistemic stream of data, we might call it, that is accessible to the subjective practitioner that is inaccessible to the objective edic person? So I think that sort of methodological complexity is really, really an important part of this work, is because you have this emic, edic, objectivist, subjective, intersubjective sort of epistemic framing kind of weave throughout this, which allows for quite a bit of methodological complexity. So I think those are all very good, important sources of knowledge that this book provides and potential audiences.
Fascinating. Is there anything else about the volume that you hope to be touched on for today?
I think that the volume is important because it repositions Jain practices out of the basket of visual culture, material culture, ritual studies, and so forth, the temple studies, and into the framework of what Jains themselves think about when they engage these practices contemplatively. The final thing that I would mention, which is very important to most of the Jains that I've spoken to, is the idea that these practices, they are meant for attaining a transcendent goal, but there's also the idea that the possibility of expansive use or application of these various contemplative methods for the awakening of empathy, compassion, and engaged activism that doesn't just take you to a liberated state, but takes you to an embodied expression of that liberated state in compassion and ahimsa.
If I were going to add a final word, it would be a word of like utmost gratitude to my mentors, Dr. Rita Sharma and Dr. Purushottama Bilmoria, for including me in this project as a grad student and really getting me interested in the field of Jain studies, and also providing me research opportunities in that important field, which I'm now working in. I'd also really want to thank all of our contributing authors who really produced some top-rate scholarship here. There's about a dozen of them. I don't want to just read through the list of all of the authors, but certainly please do obtain a list of the table of contents, and you can see the sort of venerated, esteemed scholars of Jain studies who I'm referring to, who really produced some top-rate work and allowed for this sort of synthesis where all these sort of disparate chapters really do work together in a harmonious flow. So I would thank my co-authors and our editors for all of that.
I'd like to also acknowledge the immense input and work from Dr. Paul Jinvahanek. He joined the project when he was completing his doctorate, and the project finally became completed when he was had a position as faculty. And so also to our authors, of course, tremendous appreciation. And my hope that this will just be the beginning of this coherent and cohesive approach to Jain practices, that they are not cut up into fragments, but looked at as a kind of a continuum of practices that move the individual towards the goal of Jain Dharma. Thank you so much.
Thank you both for appearing on the podcast today.
All right. Thank you for having us. It's been lovely.
Pleasure.
For those listening, you're most welcome. We've been speaking with Drs. Kojin Vanik and Rita D. Sharma, co-editors, along with Dr. Purushottama Bilmoria of Contemplative Studies in Jainism. As usual, the links from the podcast notes, feel free to have a look at it, at the illustrious table of contents and the abstract, et cetera, et cetera. Until next time, keep well, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating contemplation in all of its varieties around the world. Take care.